19th century child of the Lutheran Church in Copenhagen, Denmark, born 1813, died 1855. We've been looking at the writings from his later period, mostly from 1850 to 1855. And we're working on the book, Attack Upon Christendom. My name is Ron Marshall, and I'm a Lutheran pastor in Seattle, Washington. That's all for the record. And the FBI. Okay. There's a few little things to pass out here. And we're going to take those as long as they last.
Are these the same things, Ron?
No. No, they're different. The other one. I want to try to do three things. I want to start out and I want to identify two passages from the New Testament that seem to be very important to Kierkegaard, which might help. John Cobb, in his little book on political theology, has a nice section in there on hermeneutics, and he says that the interpretation of the text isn't nearly as important as the selection of the text. There are so many texts, there are so many Bible verses. While it's important to understand, to have some understanding what the Bible verse means to you, it's also important for you to understand why you picked the one you did to try to understand what it means. The selection itself is very, very important. So I think if you are able to see some of the verses Kierkegaard selected, that might help understand a little bit why he's so right or wrong. Okay, for you. And here are a couple of them. One text that's very, very important to him is from Luke's Gospel, the second chapter. And this is the story when Mary and Joseph take Jesus, the baby Jesus, to the temple for the presentation and the cleansing of Mary. And there Simeon has his famous song, you know, "Now lettest thou thy servant depart in peace," the Nunc Dimittis. Well, Kierkegaard likes the second part. Starting with verse 34, "And Simeon blessed them and said to Mary his mother, Behold, this child is set for the fall and rising of many in Israel, and for a sign that is spoken against, and a sword will pierce through your own soul, that thoughts out of many hearts may be revealed." The thing that Kierkegaard played on in that verse is that Jesus is a sign that is set, in other translations, it's a sign of contradiction. Or a sign of one who's spoken against, and for a purpose. He will be a crisis. Jesus will be a crisis for people. And the reason for it here in this prophecy is so that the thoughts out of the hearts of many will be revealed. The cover-up that we are all involved in will be fought against through this one of God, Jesus, the Christ. He will fight against the cover-up that we're all involved in. And so the thoughts of our hearts will be revealed. So part of the offensiveness in Jesus that Kierkegaard seems to lift up and promote, that's the text that he goes back to on that, that gives one of his motivations for it. Okay? We could also say of him that it has to do with his family life, why he's attracted to a text like that, why he selected that text, but that's one of the texts that he works over again and again and again. That Jesus, the prophecy goes, when he's just 8 days and being brought to the temple, this child is set for the fall and rising of many in Israel, and for a sign that is spoken against, that the thoughts, many hearts, may be revealed. And the other text that is very important to him, and I think it's especially important for Lutherans, and important for him as a Lutheran, is from Paul's Corinthian correspondence, the second book of Corinthians, the sixth chapter. And it's that opening, well, he likes the whole chapter, because that's the chapter of the great antitheses. We are dead, though we live. Okay. We have been persecuted, but we have not been killed. You know, these great antitheses, he liked those a lot. But the opening of the sixth chapter was very, very important to him. And there aren't many texts that speak this way. So he may have been hiding behind it. I don't know. But it goes like, it opens like this. Working together with him, then, we entreat you not to accept the grace of God in vain. Not to accept the grace of God in vain. And that's where Kierkegaard may, because he dwells on that, accepting it in vain, we're called not to accept it in vain. That's where Kierkegaard can appear to be a works righteousness person, because of this great preoccupation with accepting the grace of God in vain. And at the front of most of what he did, he declares that we are justified by grace. Grace is primary. It's chronologically primary. It's logically primary for him. But with his elaboration of trying to block the efforts of us all, himself included, to take that grace in vain, it may appear as though he reduces the priority of grace. And maybe he does. But it goes back to that text for him, 2 Corinthians 6. Okay. Now, the second thing I want to do is get a few more of the passages out from this book, Attack on Christendom. And then we'll talk a little bit more about the same thing we were talking about yesterday. That is this wedge that Kierkegaard seemed to be driving between the Christian faith and community. He's very worried about the crowd, about people's herd instinct being nurtured. He wants to block that. He wants to blunt it. I don't think he wants to destroy it, but he certainly wants to de-emphasize it. Now, for some, if you de-emphasize something, you've wrecked it. The only way this thing can live for you is if it's number one. If it's number two, it's dead. It can't be number two. So that's another way in which it may be the case that while Kierkegaard only understands himself to be driving a wedge and saying that this is not identical to the Christian faith, there's no collapse going on here, he in fact has ended up doing more than that. But his self-understanding, I believe, is just to demote community to second place. So we're going to look at some of those passages. Before I do that, there's one other passage from Training to Christianity that we looked at a couple days ago that I want to get out because I think it's kind of a nice, it sets the stage for what the passages that we're going to look at in Attack Upon Christendom. This is a buried text, but it's on page 109 in Training Christianity. But it says something quite characteristic of him regarding the life of the church and this herd instinct. Okay. At the top of page 109. But as in Christendom, everything has been brought to confusion, so also this. And thereby the point has been reached where Christianity has become paganism. In Christendom, they preach perpetually about what happened then after Jesus' death, how he triumphed, how his disciples made a triumphal conquest of the whole world. In short, one hears only sermons which might properly end with hurrah, rather than with amen. I think that's an interesting observation on his part. It's a self-revealing one. He doesn't want the proclamation of the gospel of Jesus Christ to be something where you say at the end of it, hurrah! That's great! Instead, it's to be something where after you hear it, you say amen. Which we understand to be, let that be so for me too. There's kind of a pathos in amen that isn't in hurrah! And he wants that to be there. Now, there's a text, it's on page 158 that I want to start with. It's one that was pointed out to me at the end of the last class. You see the same thing going on here. Look at this description of the church. It has the same theme of the hurrah or the amen. In the middle of page 158 in Attack Upon Christendom. Just as if one of the composers who composed variations upon one or more movements of a funeral march were to take occasion to compose with free poetic license a dashing gallop. Right in the middle of that funeral march, so has official Christianity taken occasion from some sentences in the New Testament, this doctrine of the cross and anguish and horror and shuddering before eternity, to compose with free poetic license a lovely idyll with procreating of children and waltzes, where everything is so joyful, so joyful, so joyful, where the priest, a kind of leader of the town band, is willing for money to let Christianity, the doctrine of dying unto the world, furnish the music for weddings and christenings, where everything is joy and mirth in this, according to the teaching of Christianity, a veil of tears and a penitentiary. This glorious world, yes, according to the New Testament, it is time, a time of prohibition related to an accounting and judgment, a foretaste of a still small joyful eternity which the priest guarantees to those families which by their devotion to him have evinced a sense for the eternal. Kierkegaard does not want to see a dashing gallop in the middle of a funeral march. And that character of the Christian faith, that dimension of the Christian faith, which we could illustrate with a funeral march, he believes has been gutted by introducing into it a dashing gallop. Now, at one point in the book Training Christianity, he says, my stress in understanding the Christian faith and presenting the Christian faith is a Lenten stress. Now, you suspected that all along, but he says it flat out. The season of the church year, which most clearly represents what he's interested in, is the season of Lent. Now, you could fudge on that text and say, well, what he's appealing to is the historic place wherein people, the historic place in the church here where people were trained in Christianity, and that was during the season of Lent. And then the catechumens came in at the Easter Vigil and were baptized and entered into the church then. And so it could be an appeal to that, but I think it's more than that. That season of Lent represents something to him very fundamental. Okay, and so he doesn't want to see that dashing gallop take place. He doesn't want to see that dashing gallop take place. Last time we also looked at the one text on the Spirit as being a solitary, when the Spirit of Christ is nurtured in an individual, their solitariness is nurtured. And one of the determining traits of being filled with the Christian spirit is to be a solitary person. And we looked at page 286. I just want to point out a couple other pages there for you where that theme is developed. 162, 167, and 186. We can look at the 167 one for a second. That seems to be one of the more developed renderings of it. Starts at the bottom of 166. God's thought in introducing Christianity was, if I may venture to say so, to pound the table hard in front of us men. To that end, he set individual and race, the single person and the many, at odds, set them against one another, applied the determinant of dissension. For to be a Christian was, according to his thought, precisely the definition of dissension, that of the individual with the race, with the millions, with family, with father and mother. God did it that way, partly out of love. For he, the God of love, wanted to be loved, but is too great a connoisseur of what love is to want to have to order men to love him by battalions of, or whole nations, as the command 1, 2, 3 is given at the church parade. No, the formula constantly is the individual in opposition to the others. Okay, there you see that theme, just flat-footed. And partly he did it as the ruler, in order to keep men in check and educate them. This was his thought, even though we men might say, if we dare, that it was the most annoying caprice on the part of God,
to put us together in this way, or cut us off in this way, from what we animals regard as true well-being, from coalescing with the herd, everything just like the others. Okay, then page 186, same view there where he talks about the public. Want to now draw attention to a very weird passage. It talks about a new holiday that the church should have on December 17th. Starts at the bottom of page 242. This may be a pathological path. This may reveal this man was sick.
After 2 weeks,
yeah. But on the other hand, it may be one of the most trenchant criticisms the church has ever been written of the church. So I don't know. So much of it for me goes that way. I mean, either it is just right on the money or it is just completely off the mark. But see what you think of this. Contemporaneousness, two-thirds of the way down on 242. Contemporaneousness is the decisive thought, that thing of being right there with Jesus, somehow imagining to yourself, transporting yourself, to be there right along with Jesus, so that the hearing of his words is coupled with seeing what happens to him. That's so important for him. And the technical term for that for him is being contemporary with Jesus. So he says, contemporaneousness is the decisive thought. Now, imagine a witness to this truth. That is one of the derivative patterns. For a long time he holds out, suffering all sorts of ill treatment and persecution. Finally they take his life. Cruelly they determine the manner of his death, that he is to be burnt alive. With inventive cruelty, they determine more precisely that over a slow fire, he is to be broiled upon a grill. Imagine this. Earnestness in Christianity require that thou make this so vivid to thyself that thou dost experience the suffering thou must have experienced if in the contemporary situation thou hadst recognized the man for what he is, a witness to the truth. And there he is on the grill being broiled to death. This is earnestness and Christianity. Rather different is the bestial practice to which the priest makes no objection. Thus one bids goodbye to the witness to the truth and all his sufferings, and yet, no, this is not yet the really bestial thing. No, one says, well, we'll not forget the glorious one, the witness to truth, who was broiled on the grill. We'll not forget this glorious one. Therefore we resolve that December 17th, which was the day of his death, shall be celebrated in his memory. And in order to keep it in mind, the impression of his life, and in order that our life too may acquire some likeness to him, as an effort in that direction, be it solemnly ordained that every household shall eat broiled fish. Broiled, be it noted. Do not miss the point. Upon a grill, and the most delicious part the priest shall have. That is the divine worship, which consists in suffering for the truth. Yea, suffering unto death is exchanged for the worship of eating and drinking, with the priest getting the best piece. The genuine official Christianity, where the priest, like the broiled fish in its way, contributes his part in exalting the solemnity of the day by a charming speech, it may be, thereby assuring himself of an increasing income in the course of years, perhaps of making a brilliant career, perhaps so brilliant that he goes clad in silk and velvet, bedecked with stars and ribbons. We remember the one who was hanged upon a cross, who bled up there, and probably died by suffocation when his diaphragm tore apart from his lungs and he could no longer breathe. And he choked and gasped, breathed his last, and died. We remember him week after week by drinking wine and eating bread. For Kierkegaard, I think, that was as disgusting to him as this story about the guy who was burned alive, and they commemorate his life every year by eating broiled fish. On page 35, you get a little more of this. You ready?
No.
Just a little better. No, one can well be alone in being a Christian. And if one is not very strong in the spirit, a good maximum of human prudence is, the fewer the better. And above all in Christendom, the fewer the better. Above all in Christendom, the fewer the better. I tried that on the evangelism and stewardship drive in our church. The fewer, the better. What do you think of that? We think you need a vacation, Pastor Marshall. The fewer, the better. And above all in Christendom, the fewer, the better. For in the last resort, precisely to the concept church, is to be traced the fundamental confusion both of Protestantism and of Catholicism. Or is it to the concept Christendom, Christ required followers, and defined precisely what he meant, that they should be salt, willing to be sacrificed, and that a Christian meant, and a Christian means to be salt, and to be willing to be sacrificed, and to be salt and to be sacrificed is not something which thousands naturally lend themselves, still less millions, or still less countries, kingdoms, states, and absolutely not the whole world. On the other hand, if it is a question of gain and of mediocrity and of twaddle, which is the opposite of being salt, then the possibility of things begins already with 100,000 increases with every million, reaching its highest point when the whole world has become Christian. For this reason, man is interested and employed in winning whole nations of Christians, kingdoms, lands, a whole world of Christians. For thus the thing of being a Christian becomes something different from what it is in the New Testament. And this end has been attained, has been best attained, indeed completely in Protestantism, especially in Denmark, in the Danish, even-tempered, jovial mediocrity. When one sees what it is to be a Christian in Denmark, how could it occur to anyone that this is what Jesus Christ talks about? Cross and agony and suffering, crucifying the flesh, suffering for the doctrine, being salt, being crucified. No, in Protestantism, especially in Denmark, Christianity marches to a different melody, to the tune of, merrily we go along, roll along, roll along. Christianity is enjoyment of life, tranquilized, as neither the Jew nor the pagan was, by the assurance that the thing about eternity is settled, and settled precisely in order that we might find pleasure in enjoying this life, as well as any pagan or Jew. That merrily we roll along, roll along, roll along. See? That he's worried about in the celebration of the Eucharist. That the celebration of the Eucharist, you're not drawn up short. To me, in the Eucharistic liturgy, the thing that draws me up short is the words, in the night in which he was betrayed. For him, instead, the Eucharistic liturgy at the center of the church was a merrily we roll along, roll along, roll along. And so, to try and create a sign of contradiction there, in Jesus, the center of that meal, he tells this story about December 17th. And the man whose life was commemorated on that day, remembering how he was burned alive and commemorating it by eating broiled fish. That kind of disdain for the trauma that the witness to the truth endured. That disdain for the trauma by having such a merry commemoration. Okay? Now he's dwelling on a dimension of it, isn't he? You'd say he's exaggerating. He's not seen the whole thing. There is a victory in that death. Why not dwell on the victory? You know, let's get with it. But he's worried about disdain, and he's worried about 2 Corinthians 6, that we, I entreat you not to take the grace of God in vain. Okay. Now, it's no wonder, and I'm sure this will be just confirming something you've been thinking about anyway, that, I mean, a person can't get away with that kind of stuff. You just can't. Can you? No, you can't. Some dame today was telling me that there is an expression in Denmark called first CERN. She's like, go to hell. Okay? Go to the devil. Look on page 259, where he talks about his name, CERN. The attack upon me for the benefit of the witnesses to the truth, whose silence is thereby made thoroughly manifest, is conducted by the Copenhagen Post and the Flying Post, and the point, the deadly sting of their attack is that I am called CERN. Only one thing now is lacking, that as a witness to the truth, Bishop Martinson too might, if there should be another rumpus, so that the bishop, like the boys on New Year's Eve, might think that he saw his chance, write an article against me, making the point that I am called CERN. That I must sink down, succumb before the power of the truth, which in vain I should strive to resist. For the truth is, my name is CERN. Beloved father of mine, deceased, to think that thou shouldst become my misfortune, viewed ideally, I have conquered, I deserve to, but my name is CERN. But I shall put up with it, oh my God, gladly and thankfully, put up with a bad temper of impotence. But it is another question whether the Danish people is well served by the labor to make it ridiculous, ridiculous to the eyes of every other nation which learns to know that this is a people among which the only argument used against mind and spirit is that the man is called CERN. Okay. Well, the name, that Walter Lowry, it says in his biography that after Kierkegaard lived and died, people quit calling their kids CERN. And it took on this character of a curse word. I've got a little handout here. I wish I had more of them because this is my only X-rated handout. And it'd been nice to have more of them, but it's on the name CERN with a pornographic cartoon along with it. That is a reproduction that comes from 1945, but it's supposed to be something that came from the papers in the 19th century. And this is from his journals on himself, his name. He says, to such an extent that the fact that I received the poor and unfortunate name CERN has been a downright hindrance to my becoming regarded as being somebody. No, in order for it to be conceivable in Copenhagen that I'm a thinker, I really must have to have a nicer name. This may be denied, but nevertheless it is the case. For one thing, people are so provincial-minded, and for another, if anyone says so, they deny it. And then Howard Enda Hong, in their footnote, have this about the name CERN. As a result of the repeated caricaturing of Kierkegaard by the Corsair, that comic newspaper, not only his legs and clothing became occasions for ridicule and harassment on the streets, but also his name CERN, which lent itself as a taunt word because in popular Danish usage it also means devil. So there was that kind of... like I say, you just don't get away with the kind of scathing criticisms that he leveled to his community without having a reaction. And that's the kind of reaction. Now, the cartoon is, maybe just the people in the front will get it, but one of the pictures of Kierkegaard is in the hat, the broad-rimmed hat. And Kierkegaard's first book was called Either Or. The second volume of that was The Diary of the Seducer. And the point he was trying to make is one that Steve Harms made the other day here, that the chief problem of the church is not persecution, but seduction. We're getting seduced by the culture in which we live. And that was his thing on war tax resistance. But they said, the critics of that book said, oh, he's talking about the seduction of the church by the culture, but actually what Kierkegaard's, it's a veiled sexual problem with him. He really wants to be a womanizer. So they made fun of him with the cartoons, and here's the picture of him with his big hat sneaking out of the chambers of a half-clothed woman.
What's it say underneath
it? It's in Danish. But I'm told what it says underneath it is, there he is researching, trying to find a good cover for his book, The Diary of a Seducer.
Something like that.
Yeah. So they meet something in his own time.
Yes. Yes. But like I say, I mean, you still tell stories like that about the church. You know, about the guy who's burned alive, and that they commemorate each year by eating broiled fish. And that's what all you were doing? You go up to the communion rail and drink the wine and eat the bread? Here's another characteristic text from the book on 244. We men are prone by nature to regard life in this way. We consider suffering an evil, which in every way we strive to avoid. First time you said something true. Linda? We consider suffering an evil which in every way we strive to avoid. And if we succeed in this, we think that when our last hour comes, we have special reason for thanking God that we have been spared suffering. We think that everything depends upon slipping through life happily and well. And Christianity thinks that all that is terrible really comes from the other world, that the terrible things of this world are as child's play compared with eternity, and that it distinctly does not depend upon slipping through this life happily and well, but upon relating oneself rightly by suffering to eternity. One lives only once. If when death comes, thy life is well spent, that is, spent so that it is related rightly to eternity, then God be praised eternally. If not, then it is irredeemable, for one lives only once. This distinction for him between spending one's life and saving one's life was very crucial. And he saw the established church in his day to be nurturing the desire to save your life, to keep it free of suffering and turmoil and distress, rather than to promote the spending of one's life. Just spend it. Use it up. Let your life be consumed. Okay. That again is playing off that theme about dying to the world. Okay? That the life is to be spent.
Was he married? Did he have any children or anything like that?
No, he was engaged to be married, and he broke off his engagement to Regina Olson, which is one of the four crises in his life, according to the biographers. And he talked a lot about why that happened. And the correspondence are available between Kierkegaard and Regina Olson. Those have recently been translated. You can read them. All kinds of proposals come out. We talked a little bit about that. But I think the final word is what he said at the end. He said, I'll go to my grave with a secret why the engagement was broke. But it was. He grew up in a Lutheran family, very staunch Lutheran family. His father was very rigid, severe Lutheran, the Danish church. And he went to college and went to the seminary, trained to be a Lutheran pastor, but never accepted a call to be a pastor. So never served the church as a pastor, but worshiped every week. Every week. I don't know, I shouldn't say that. But I think a lot of churches have a figure something like Kierkegaard sitting in the back row. You know? And, they're not quite sure why they're there, but they're there regularly and mostly dissatisfied with what goes on. But don't talk a lot about it. Kind of quiet about it. But the few times you get words from them, they're words of dissatisfaction. His involvement seemed to be something like that. But he was not a pastor. But at the home in which he lived, the father was a very successful clothes merchant. So they were an aristocratic family. A lot of money.
It seems like he spent an awful lot of time thinking about religion.
Yes. It consumed him. In some sense.
And he had a lot of trouble with it. And maybe he even wasn't
That's right.
Did he die young?
He died at 42. Died young.
And what did he die of?
Well, kind of like consumption, I guess. Also, he was out on the streets. At that time, he'd given away all the money that was left. He kind of lived as a pauper the last year or so. And died in the gutter.
Or did they...
The students did, apparently.
...take him as a sort of a friend? Or how was he treated by the church?
His books didn't sell. They didn't sell.
He did write them, though, at that time.
Yes, yes. Most of his writings were published during his lifetime. When he died, well, Kierkegaard was the seventh child born to his family. Seven children. By the time he was 20 years old, all of his siblings had died, early death, except for the oldest one, Peter, who was a pastor in Lutheran Church and became a bishop. And he and CERN did not get along at all. And at his death, Peter had the funeral. Peter had the funeral, and he was going to get the last word on Kierkegaard. And you know what happened? The funeral was busted by the students from the University of Copenhagen. They came in and demanded the body. There was a kind of a riot scene at the funeral. And they did not want Peter to officiate because they knew how much CERN disdained his older brother, who he thought had capitulated the whole thing. And there was a bit of a row. The upshot of it was that Peter ended up officiating, doing the funeral. The students were driven out. And at the family grave today, the marker for Kierkegaard's grave in the family plot was never put in place. It's there. It has the poem on it from the Norwegian pietist poet that he wanted to have on his gravestone. But the stone was never put in place because they feared that the body would be exhumed. And that's one of the few instances of any kind of popularity, you know, where people kind of banded together to defend him. But it's kind of ironic, isn't it?
Well,
now the guy's
I
long.
I think it might be kind of usual.
Maybe so.
Because I think that young people like to look at all sides of things, and if things are a little bit different than what their parents believe, that's kind of popular, at least for a while.
No, I think,
you know, it's sort of against the establishment.
Yeah, I think there's a real distinct truth to that observation, that in a way it's not surprising that the students were there.
It would be the students, the young people.
Yeah. But it also shows us something about the breadth of his appeal. It was pretty narrow then, wasn't it? Yeah. At 29, he talks about the crew. Churches, the crew. The religious situation in our country is Christianity. That is Christianity, the New Testament, and everything else is not Christianity, least of all by calling itself such. Christianity does not exist, as almost anyone must be able to see as well as I. We have, if you will, a complete crew of bishops, deans, and priests, learned men, eminently learned, talented, gifted, humanly well-meaning. They all declaim, doing it well, very well, eminently well, or tolerably well, or badly, but not one of them is in the character of Christianity in the New Testament. But if such is the case, the existence of this Christian crew is so far from being Christianly considered advantageous to Christianity that it is far rather a peril. Because it is so infinitely likely to give rise to a false impression and the false inference that when we have such a complete crew, we must of course have Christianity too. A geographer, for example, when he has assured himself of the existence of this crew, would think that he was thoroughly justified in putting into his geography the statement that the Christian religion prevails in the land. We have what one might call a complete inventory of churches, bells, organs, benches, alms box, foot warmers, tables, hearses, etc. But when Christianity does not exist, the existence of this inventory, so far from being Christianly understood an advantage, is far rather a peril, because it is so infinitely likely to give rise to a false impression and the false inference that when we have such a complete Christian inventory, we must of course have Christianity too. The statistician, for example, when he has assured himself of the existence of this Christian inventory, would think that he was thoroughly justified in putting into his statistics the statement that the Christian religion is the prevailing one in the land. We are what is called a Christian nation, but in such a sense that not a single one of us is in the character of the Christianity of the New Testament, any more than I am, who again and again have repeated and do now repeat that I am only a poet. The illusion of a Christian nation is due, doubtless, to the power which number exercises over the imagination. In my work, the concern of the American Lutheran Church with these damn parochial reports, where they want to count everything, and then they want you to compare your counting. I mean, the whole thing is measured by numbers. It's not just enough how many are baptized in your congregation. We want to know how many are active contributing members in your congregation. We want to know how many members have left your church this year and how many have joined and what the difference is. We want to know how many of your active contributing members commune, take the bread and the wine each year. And we want to know how many opportunities they had to take the bread and the wine that year, so that we can estimate what percentage of those they took advantage of. And it's one of the few things, it may be the only thing that the American Lutheran Church wants besides money. They want the parochial report, and the whole thing is numbers. There isn't any place there to give impressions of the mind of Christ among us. There isn't anywhere to give impressions or to have testimonies.
Or your whole mission.
Yes. Or testimonies about what has happened to you in your spiritual journey that year. Numbers are an important thing. And then each year that parochial report comes, I know in Seattle, and everybody's checking, well, did Ballard First Lutheran's membership go down? I think it dropped. Do you have the parochial report of last year? I think it went down. Well, then some say you really can't count, because we know what they do over there. They pad the numbers. But it's this business about the power which number exercises over the imagination. This new church that the American Lutheran Church, the Lutheran Church of America, and ALC are putting together, and one of the things they talk about is, you know, gee, we're going to be 5.6 million. Maybe we'll get representatives on Nightline. Because we're big. Consider concern for numbers. That was something about the established church that bought, that one of the reasons he was so concerned about that. 140 is another one, and this kind of brings out the political dimensions of it, which are often overlooked, Kierkegaard's thought. In the middle of the page, he says, yes, this has come to pass. What Christianity needs is not the suffocating protection of the state. No, it needs fresh air. It needs persecution. And it needs God's protection. The state only works disaster. It wards off persecution, and it is not the medium through which God's protection can be conducted. Above all, save Christianity from the state. Above all, save Christianity from the state. By its protection, it smothers Christianity to death. Should the church have a tax-exempt status in the United States of America? Should it? Now, I learned that the reason we should have that is to protect the small churches that couldn't make it if they had to pay land taxes. And so it's a way of equalizing all religious efforts in this land. But has that protection smothered the church? And then he has this image as a fat lady with her corpse overlies her baby. And it teaches Christianity the most disgusting bad habits, as, for example, under the name of Christianity, to employ the power of the police. Do we know of an instance in the Lutheran Church where that happened? Right? In Pittsburgh, Pastor Doug Roth. There the bishop tried to take him out of his call. The congregation was split. You know the story about it. It's been in the papers. It was hard to know who the adjudicatory body in that church was because the church council had split. But look, the ones that stayed said Roth remains the pastor. But the ones who left, who were the older members of the church, they said he has to be taken out of the congregation. So the bishop followed the word of the group that had left the council and came into the congregation and said, you must leave the congregation. You no longer have a legitimate call at this place to be its pastor. And Doug Roth said, you have made a mistake in your judgment as a bishop. I, therefore, am not leaving this parish. And so rather than trying to employ some other means within the church, the bishop, what does he do? He goes to the county sheriff. And what does the county sheriff say? If the county sheriff had a modicum of sense, he would say, he would have reprimanded him like a bad little boy. He said, go back and get your house in order, for God's sakes. Right? But the county sheriff brings 40 deputies with rifles.
It was a whole city thing, though. By then it split the whole city.
Yeah. Is anybody here from Pittsburgh that was there when that happened?
All had to do with money and jobs.
Yeah. And the sheriff came in with his 40 deputies with rifles and hauled him away in handcuffs. And it teaches Christianity the most disgusting bad habits. As, for example, under the name of Christianity, to employ the power of the police. Who knows the story of the Third Reich well? And what the Deutsche Kirche did in trying to stop pastors from praying. Stop them from praying for the children of Abraham and Sarah. That was the euphemism that they used. They prayed for the children of Abraham and Sarah. And they were told they could no longer pray for the children of Abraham and Sarah. And I just wonder what the mechanics was like to get the Secret Service into those churches. Because the bishops of the Deutsche Kirche, the state church, supported it all. And if that was another instance where the church exhibited its disgusting bad habits of making use of the power of the police.
Who's doing the one down south with the 10 youth children in El Salvador and having quiet there? Who decided to fight between the churches?
Okay, you're talking about the case that's now in litigation in the Lutheran Church in Arizona or the Central American thing? Yeah. Well, the Lutheran Church involved is Elzano Lutheran Church in downtown Phoenix. Do we have anybody here from downtown Phoenix? Elzano Lutheran Church? Jim Oinas is the pastor there. And they were infiltrated by informers. And the presiding bishop of the American Lutheran Church, David Preuss, met with Alan Nelson, the head of INS, and Ed Meese, the head of the Justice Department, and asked them, they're both members of the American Lutheran Church in Virginia. And he asked them, says, your presiding bishop, can you tell me something about the Elzano Lutheran Church that I don't know, that I should know about in order to do my work properly? Was there some reason why you had to infiltrate it? Was there some reason why you needed to collect information by infiltration rather than by grand juries or subpoenas or something like that? And Jim Oinas told me that David Preuss told him, that Alan Nelson and Ed Meese told him, so it's third hand, I don't know, it's reliable, but he said no, there wasn't any information that we couldn't have gotten otherwise that we needed to get through infiltration. The only reason we infiltrated the church is because we aimed to destroy it. And we knew that if we got infiltrators in the church and the cover was blown, there were infiltrators in the church, the Hispanic, there were 60-some, Hispanic refugees that were involved in the church, they would flee. And they did. Scared to death. So they just scattered. And they were doing three or four things to those people. They were providing meals. They were providing job service. They were providing housing. And they were also doing extended Bible studies with them. And Preuss said, well, can you promise me that you won't do that again? And Alan Nelson and Ed Meese said, no, we can't. We aim to destroy all the churches in America that are promoting the sanctuary movement. And he said, even though it's illegal what you're doing? And they said, yes, because it has to be stopped. So he said, you leave me no choice then but to sue you. And well, you got to do what you think is right. So on January 13th, the American Lutheran Church joined with the United Presbyterian Church in America and filed a lawsuit against the federal government for violation of the First Amendment, separation of church and state. So yes, the use of the police at El Zona Lutheran Church, and there's 5 Presbyterian churches and the same thing happened. Well, it's like Richard Nixon. You know, sometimes you have to break the law in order to enforce it. But we'll test it out in the courts and see what happens. Now, El Zona Lutheran Church, they did not want to enter the lawsuit with the United Presbyterians. The good Lutherans. Romans 13. All power is there by God's will. They didn't want to enter the lawsuit. What they want to do is file a friend of the court brief and say that they were a friend of the court with the United Presbyterians but didn't want to enter. And when the lawyer for the ALC came down to work that thing out and saw what the details of the whole thing were, he went back to the Executive Council of the Church and said, this is a monumental debacle. And we have to do more than file a friend of the court brief. And so they went back to El Zona Lutheran Church, and they had to get a 2/3 vote. And I said, well, Jim, what was that meeting like? And he said, it was astounding. He said, what happened was, nobody stood up and said it's an unpatriotic thing to do, to file, and his congregation is 2/3 retired. Nobody stood, and Phoenix, Arizona, I mean, let's face it, it's not Haight-Ashbury. But do you know what he said? They said, these retired folks, they stood up and they said, I don't think we should file, we should join them in this litigation, because if we did that, the government surely find out who the members of this church are, and they will probably withhold my Social Security. And Jim said, my God, that's the reason why we've got to do this. If you're afraid that your government is going to withhold your Social Security because of your political views, we've got to file this lawsuit. And the vote won by one vote. They got 2/3 by one vote. And he said, I know those people. And it wasn't because they didn't want to vote for it, but they were scared. And I said, Jim Oinous, I don't know if any of you know Jim, but he's a classmate of mine and in the Midwest, and he doesn't have a radical bone in his body. And I said, Jim, what's it like down there? He said, it's like Nazi Germany, Ron. It's like Nazi Germany down there. He said, I am scared to death. I am so scared of my government. I've never been, he said, it's just so foreign. He's from some little farm community in Iowa. I just never thought I'd ever be in a situation like that. Kierkegaard worried that when the church gets kind of monolithic, this big thing, that it goes to bed with the state. It's very important for us to remember that context, isn't it? That he was talking about a specific organization at a specific time in a specific place and no interest in generalizing it. So we ask, why are we reading this stuff? Well, we're reading it. Well, I don't know. Why are we reading it? But I mean, one reason maybe. One reason maybe is there a parallel? Is there a parallel? Now that's pretty ambitious to read it with that question in mind. But that might be one reason why we're reading. Is there a parallel?
You said there were 4 big things in his life, and one of them was the breakup of his engagement. What were the other 3?
Well, the first one was the dealing with his father. That his rigorous relationship with his father. He found out that his father was a cad after, presenting himself as this impeccable source of religious purity. his first wife, when his first wife died, he ended up marrying the maid in the household who became the mother of all seven of the children. And Peter was born 4 months after they were married. So, you know, Cern figured it out. He was screwing around with the maid while the mother was still alive. And that just shattered him. The second one was the broken engagement. The third one was the encounter with the Corsair magazine, newspaper in Copenhagen, this big conflict with Goldschmidt, who was the editor of it, and this vitriolic exchange of letters. It was kind of a literary fight. And then the last one was the attack on the church and Bishop Martensen, who was one of his former teachers, who he greatly admired. And he saw the professor became a bishop, he went to hell. He just fell all apart, caved in, lost all of his critical awareness, and was just down the chute. Merrily we go along. And that really hurt him. This is something also I think that we don't always remember about Kierkegaard, is that he loved the church.